Welcome once again, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. We're going to make it college style for the first one of 2009. I'm John Manuel. He is Aaron Fitt. Just back from, just flew in from San Diego, and we're actually both very well rested. So
my arms are tired, though, John.
I was going to say, thankfully, we had an airplane. So I was going to play off the bad joke and make a good joke, but you foiled my attempt.
I'm all about bashing our listeners over the head.
We have been hanging out this weekend with Lee Folger, CEO and president of Baseball America, and he's the king of the bad joke, so sometimes it rubs off. But we appreciate the download. Thank you. Happy New Year. Happy holidays. All of that good stuff. Happy Festivus. I think it's we need to throw that in now to be politically correct. But Aaron, we just got back from San Diego. The American Baseball Coaches Association convention was held there. So we'll talk a little college baseball, and we'll start the new year. We petered out on our resolution last year about through August, but we'll make it our resolution again in 2009 to answer more email on the podcasts. We did a great job in the first half of 08. So we'll try to get an 09. podcast@baseballamerica.com is the email address, and we'll do our best to address those every week here at the Baseball America podcast. And Aaron, you know, this weekend's convention, really what it does is it gives us a chance to get a lot of face time with a lot of college baseball coaches at all levels. And I think it's a very under-the-radar kind of event. Even we really never make that big of a deal of it, even when there is news at the ABCA convention. But for us, there wasn't a lot of news. But let's catch people up, I think, a little bit on what has gone on in college baseball since June, since Fresno State won the College World Series. It really, last year was the first year of a lot of changes in college baseball. My sense is this being the first ABCA convention since the introduction of roster cap, roster limit basically of 35 players, since the transfer rule where players have to sit out a year, and since teams are mandated now by the NCAA to give each player who gets scholarship aid at least a 25% scholarship, that coaches are really not happy with those changes from the NCAA. That's a very easy way to put it, I think, is they're disappointed in the direction of the sport, whereas in past years, I thought that the ABCA, most of the 10 years I'd been going, coaches were encouraged by the direction of the sport.
You know, it's interesting, John. I didn't hear really any coach say that they were pleased with the changes, which...
Even a single part of the changes.
Right, and you know, of course, part of that, I think, is... we get more emails from upset readers than we do from pleased readers.
That's a good point.
You're much more likely to express your displeasure than you are your satisfaction. So I think that's part of it. I do think that most coaches now at this point have accepted that these changes are here for now. At least they're not going to change.
The NCAA, at least a couple of years, the NCAA is going to let this.
The NCAA has made it perfectly clear that they're going to leave this stuff, this package in place in its entirety for at least a couple of years so they can get more data to study it.
Which, of course, is ironic because they didn't do that with the APR, which led to baseball's poor performance in the academic progress reports. And so even though baseball was making improvements in its APR, that wasn't good enough. The presidents had a real problem with baseball performance.
It was impatience. I mean, that's why we've got these changes. The board of directors was acted rashly, but
I was going to say a lot of I words: impatience, irrationality. Those are the two ones that are the most ignorant. I think those are the three biggest words.
That said, we are where we are, and
it is what it is.
Dave Collins has told the coaches, look, there's nothing we can do about this right now. So
basically wear it for a while.
That's it.
Figure out how to deal with it.
So I think there was still some talk of that this weekend from some of the usual suspects, I think, who were particularly displeased with the changes. But, and there was at the business meeting this year, the Division I business meeting, usually one of the highlights of this weekend for us as far as news goes.
Right.
Pretty uneventful. I mean, there was really just a lot of recapping of things that were discussed at the meeting in Indianapolis with about 164 Division I coaches.
We haven't
last
podcasted
month.
About that meeting either, so I think it's important to talk about that as well because it's a review for us, but I think it is new for readers who haven't read those stories. The basics are that the college coaches actually got together before their convention. I think that's the most impressive thing, and talked about. Okay, they want us to wear it. They want us to. These are the changes. Deal with it. They basically met to discuss how to deal with it. some of the suggestions that are really on the table in the NCAA legislation sound like, A, more scholarships. I think you and I both agree. Boy, it would be great if college baseball had 14 scholarships. Right. That seems like almost overreaching. They were at 13 back before the last reduction to 11.7. I'd say the chances of baseball getting back to 13 or 14 scholarships are, what, 5%, 2%? Am I being too pessimistic?
You know, I think they've got a shot at it. I just think that it's not, you know, I still think it's at least 2 years away. I do think that eventually I get the feeling that there's momentum building to increase the scholarships at least a little bit.
I really doubt that's going to happen, though, because that would be the first time that any men's sport would get more scholarships since Title IX enforcement really began.
That's a good point.
And in the economy that we're in now, I don't see any college being flush with cash to say, yeah, let's spend more money on men's sports.
No, that's a very good
point.
There's
not a whole lot of that happening, and the only men's sports that more money gets spent on really are, A, if you have a baseball program that makes money, or if you have another program that's an Olympic sport that makes money, which are very rare, or B, football and basketball.
Right.
So I have significant doubts about increasing the scholarship. It's great they want it to happen. I have significant doubts about the NCAA saying anything other than a 12-word answer that's basically 12, the word no 11 times. And
it is, I think, encouraging, though, for people who want this change that you know, several important NCAA figures have actually started to talk about this in terms that aren't completely dismissive.
Right.
You know, Dennis Pope, for instance, has addressed this, and now it's kind of a different tone when he talks about this issue than it was a couple of years ago, is something that maybe could happen.
Well, I think that they have a lot of educating to do, on the people who are in charge of the NCAA. And while Miles Brand is seen as being in charge of the NCAA, he's really not. It's the president's council. It's the presidents of these universities, and they just don't know. And to educate them and to demonstrate to them why more scholarships are needed for baseball is a Herculean task. And while I do think Dave Kylitz is well suited for that task, I don't know what other college baseball coaches are going to help lead that sport.
Right.
Now that Ron Polk has stepped aside as the coach of Mississippi State, maybe they have a better chance. Because frankly, Coach Polk, for all his passion and on the subject, was the wrong leader for that. For that move, because he was just throwing Molotov cocktails left and right. And maybe Tim Corbin at Vanderbilt is the guy. It seems like Tim has kind of been nominated by his peers to be that guy because he's had some success and he's well-spoken and he's from the Northeast, but he coached in the ACC at Clemson as an assistant, and now he coaches in the Southeastern Conference. He does, I think, have a unique view of the sport from being from that standpoint. But I don't know. I don't know. I think that's pretty. I don't think that would happen in the next decade. To be honest with you, I think they're a long way off from. If they can't educate the president enough to realize where their first reaction is, well, let's cut to 40 or 44 games and let's mandate 25% scholarship restrictions. I think that spending more money on scholarships is really way far in the future.
You're probably right, John. I think it'll happen. I think there's a chance, I should say, that it could happen sooner than that, maybe within the next 5 years. But here's one thing, is this issue is on the back burner a little bit. I mean, it's in the back of coaches' minds, but it's not really something that's at the forefront. At the meeting in November, Dave and the coaches established their priorities, by voting and surveys.
Right.
Dave kind of loves surveys.
Absolutely.
And the number one priority is keeping 56 games.
Right.
Even though.
And that's a surprise to me.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. That's a surprise to me. I don't know what the difference is between 50 and 56. I really don't.
And even though there are coaches now who would rather play 52 in the spring, and that's why they're playing four games in the fall.
Right.
Rice, Texas are doing this. I mean, I think you're going to see Long Beach. I think you're going to see more programs doing that in the future. But in the meantime, I think they just don't want to be told, hey, you can't play 56 games.
Right.
I think they want to have the option. Let us decide.
Great point.
But the other things, of course, that are major priorities would be, the
25% rule 20, or no?
The 25% rule is again, and that's one thing that they've just kind of accepted a little bit
here.
I think they want to speed up the pace of the game a little bit. And, the game clock is something, or the pitch, clock,
pitch
is,
clock
is one thing that I think you could see happen even this summer at the Rules Committee meeting.
I am all for pitch clock in college baseball. The pace of the game is an issue for me. It's a much lesser issue to me. I think that is a priority. It's far behind the 25% rule for me, and I think it is probably is for the coaches, but I guess they've been told to try to wear it. And I still think in the next two years of that, I would really try to revisit that as soon as I could. But the pace of the game is an issue for college baseball becoming more of a mainstream outlet for fans who are baseball fans, but not necessarily college sports fans.
Right.
The game is too slow paced. There's no doubt about it. Especially the – it just makes it a poor TV product when it takes 4 hours for games in Omaha. And part of that is maybe the style of play. But, you know, I don't think it was a coincidence, Aaron, that we're talking about doing a story on West Coast baseball for our college preview issue, which comes out in about a month. You know, West Coast teams play a slower style of baseball. And one of our award winners at the ABCA Honors Luncheon, Ken Revisa, the professor at Cal State Fullerton, a sports psychology professor, he's part of the problem, not part of the solution. Because and you can go back and read Will Kimmy's story on Jared Weaver when he was our college player of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Jared Weaver's whole thing was when anybody got on base, slow things the hell down.
Right.
And those guys, with all the pick plays, all the button defenses, all the signals, that's a slow style of play because
right.
there's so many defensive signals going on. There's so much. And the pitchers are all taught to slow things down significantly when players get on base and to dictate a slower tempo of play, which, frankly, can be maddening to watch.
Yeah, you're right. Other issues that are on the table here, the RPI.
Oh, yeah, you know, absolutely.
It's one thing that was probably – this is interesting, John, because –
that was actually talked about also in Indianapolis.
Right, that was something that –
the proposal by Greg Van Zandt of West Virginia, the head coach there.
And I think maybe he wasn't sure – you know, where his proposal would go. You know, the idea being that you assign more weight to wins on the road than you do for wins at home.
Right.
Because Northern teams, it's not fair that they've got to start their schedule really for the first 3 weeks or month of the season on the road.
There's such an imbalance. The majority of teams in the South play their – in South and in the West play the majority of their games at home, and all the teams in the North and the Northeast play the – vast majority of their games on the road. I mean,
and then you've got a compounding factor because these northern teams go on the road, and of course you're statistically more likely to lose on the road,
right?
For any number of reasons.
In any sport.
And then they go home, and they're playing all these other teams who've
done the same thing,
gone south, and had losing records. And so the RPI kind of compounds itself. So I think that this is an attempt to maybe remedy that a little bit. And the thing that was really interesting to me this weekend was that the NCAA took the time to really put together a detailed study about this and addressed it in some detail at the convention.
Right.
At the very least, you know, whether something happens here or not, you know that it caught their attention and that they're thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they also do it in other sports, there's a precedent for it. So
yeah.
Baseball's not asking for anything that's not done elsewhere.
Right.
I thought Greg Van Zandt's proposal, which you covered in the previous issue of Baseball America, also available at baseballamerica.com on the college page, covered it very thoroughly, and basically it's a very rational proposal that makes all kinds of sense. And anybody in baseball who doesn't think that Northern teams are at a disadvantage because they have to play more games on the road than they get to play at home is just deluding themselves. And when you've had – there have been teams that have played as many as 45 of their 56 games at home, Miami, while I've worked at Baseball America, and that's just – that is ridiculous. Shockingly, I believe that Miami team was the number one ranked team in the RPI at the end of the season.
Right.
And if you don't think that – basically, RPI measures wins and losses. At its base, what it measures most is wins and losses. It factors in strength of schedule. But if you play 45 of your 56 games at home, you're probably going to be 45-11.
Right.
You have a good chance of being around 45-11 when the regular season ends.
Right.
Or at least winning 40 games out of your 56. You're going to win a few on the road, but you're going to win most of your games at home. And – you know, I also think that it was telling, Aaron, that proposal and all the permutations that J.D. Hamilton of the Statistics Service with the NCAA handed out to the coaches that meeting, in all three of them, Miami, North Carolina, and Florida State were still 1, 2, 3 in whatever
That's right.
order.
That's right.
I believe it was North Carolina, Florida State, Miami was the order, 1, 2, 3 in our – no.
Miami
won. Miami,
yeah.
North Carolina, Florida State, actually.
Yeah,
And and all three, even with giving road wins more weight. Those schools stayed at the top of the RPI, so it was mostly schools from the north that moved up and some schools from the south that really weren't that good anyway that moved down. So I thought that was interesting. I think that Coach Van Zandt's proposal makes all kinds of sense, and I was able to tell him that a couple times because I seemed to run into him all over the
– I ran into him a few times myself. That's
including
funny.
At the Baseball Factory event on Saturday night after Darren Sproles' heroics and – And it was crazy to be in San Diego for that home playoff game because the city was like a college town. It blew up that night. The gas lamp district was hopping on Saturday night. So other highlights, I guess, of the event for us from a newsworthiness standpoint, having dinner with Roger Cador Friday night, the coach from Southern University. That was plus-plus. That was a well-above-average dinner.
It was. It was an outstanding dinner.
I was pretty impressed with Coach Cador's ability to put away some chicken. but he's a big man, and we love hanging out with Roger Cador. And impressive display of by the Baseball Factory people of some significant hospitality with way more pizza than could be consumed by the people who went to their event on Saturday night. But also enjoyed some of the clinics that go on every year at the ABCA. Jerry Weinstein's clinic and Don Slott's clinic were both awesome. I think you really enjoyed the Don Slott clinic, Aaron.
That was my favorite clinic of the weekend.
We both feel we can go out and hit some, at least with a metal bat anyway, do a decent job with a metal bat after listening to Don Slott.
Really fun to watch him break down the swing and frame by frame and especially the way he would compare, he would compare great big league hitters with hitters from the area code games, right, side by side, and you could really see the difference.
And it was awesome to see him do that, and it was awesome to see him pull up J.P. Ramirez, and we both knowingly looked at each other about, wow, J.P. Ramirez, he can hit. And his swing was a really sound swing.
Yeah.
And that's a 15th-round pick who got $1 million. And if Rick Jones was at that clinic, he probably had a tear in his eye. Rick was very upset to lose JP at the last minute, and he had good reason to be upset for losing JP Ramirez. The other thing that we did at the event, at least I was able to do, Aaron, whenever I talked to some college coaches, was roll some of the names, some teams in our top 25 past them. And if I talked to West Coast coaches, try to get them to rank the teams in the West. And I showed some people the questionnaires that we get back from clubs, from the college coaches. And our top 25 rankings will be released in a couple weeks. I believe we targeted the 19th, a Monday, 2 Mondays from yesterday.
Sounds about right.
To release our top 25, our preseason top 25 rankings. Rest assured it will be dramatic when we do it. And it will be I'd say that maybe we won't have as big of a surprise number one, maybe as we had last year. I think we're going to have a pretty good – I think we're going to have a lot of the usual suspects.
Right.
Because you round up a lot of the usual suspects when you do a college poll. But, I mean, the usual suspects have changed over the last few years. But let's – just to kick off a little poll discussion, why don't we talk a little bit about how we go through that process and kind of what information we're gathering. Now, how many coaches do you feel like – how many schools have you talked to already – just informally or formally in going over top 25 trying to line up teams?
Oh, quite a few. I don't think I could count them.
Upwards of 30 already?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. It's
ridiculous.
We want to make sure that we do the best job we can on this. It's not something we just throw together. There's no dartboard, but contrary to popular belief.
That's right. There is a Ouija board, but we have the spirit of never mind. That's a bad joke. I was trying to think of whose spirit we would channel to do a top 25 ranking, but I really don't know who it would be.
Good effort.
You need to be more prepared for next week's podcast.
But no, I mean it's and for us it's a combination of, there's no science to this, of course, but I like to try to break the teams down by their strengths and weaknesses, and by pitching and depth and bullpen and defense and hitting and power and all these other things, just to kind of get a sense for how they stack up. But then, of course, there's a lot of intangible factors. We've learned over the years that some coaches just get the best out of their teams every year.
That's right.
You got to give them the benefit of the doubt.
When you see Cal State Fullerton and Dave Serrano, and they have a lot of new pitchers on the staff, they lost a lot of innings, but you see that they have talent, you kind of give Dave Serrano the benefit of the doubt. He gave a clinic on how to throw, on just what you should do as a coach with your bullpens for your players. And I went just to hear him talk pitching, and so did a lot of other coaches. That place was packed
for
Dave Serrano's lecture. And the reason is Dave Serrano knows pitching, especially at the college level. So.
And I really enjoyed that clinic because especially for us non-coaches, to kind of see. He was concise, but talking to other coaches about that clinic, and there were a lot of people who went, I think, because they were curious.
Absolutely.
The guys who are kind of his rivals will tell you that, he didn't really tell us anything we didn't know.
That's exactly right.
He gave you good information, especially to maybe coaches at a lower level.
He gave you a great outline.
But he didn't give any
secrets
away.
He didn't give you the details, he didn't give away any secrets. He talked about the string. And they talk about pitching to the string, but didn't say what kind of string it was or how they set up the string, where. You know, so like you said, I was going to get to that. He was, I think it was a very good clinic from that standpoint. Like, he gave even you and I a good general idea of what we'd have a pitcher do in a bullpen.
Right.
But I think there's only a certain amount of information he gave up. And you know, whereas Jerry Weinstein, he's in pro ball. That was my personal cheese ball clinic of the weekend, pitching off the fastball. But I was fascinated to find out that only 64% of major league pitches thrown are fastballs. I really thought the percentage would be higher. And that kind of squares with something Dean Stotts at Stanford told me years ago when they were talking about charting their pitches with the ChartMind software that some Stanford graduates and Coach Stotts helped come up with when they were charting pitches on a Palm Pilot earlier in this decade. And, you know, that they had their pitchers throwing 59 or 60% fastballs. And that was Jason Young and Justin Wayne, who were two guys who signed for a combined $5.4+ million. So that was some unique arms. Both guys who briefly got to the big leagues did not establish themselves as stars or regulars even. But, you know, those were college pitchers throwing 60% fastballs. I used to think that was a low percentage, but when the major league average is 64%, that tells you that was a high percentage. I would guess that the majority of college baseball is below 50% for a number of pitches thrown that are fastballs.
And it's funny because I know this is a big thing for you, fastball
sure.
command.
Absolutely.
You
got
to, you know, throw a preponderance of the fastballs. And I talked about the Weinstein Clinic with a couple of pitching coaches this weekend.
Yep.
One of them was Eric Valenzuela, who, of course, had Brian Mattis this past year, a guy who I think has been criticized. The Orioles really want him to throw more fastballs.
Yep.
Eric said, "Hey, we told him, you know, throw first pitch changeup. You know, they told him to work off your secondary stuff a lot. They like to do that because he said, at my level, it's about winning. It's about winning, and at this level, that's a really good way to do it. There's the metal bat factor.
We'll see if it is though. They haven't won a regional yet, so
maybe they
ought to switch up some things a little bit. Maybe Eric ought to change that up a little bit. I'm not trying to be glib, but if it's about winning, San Diego has gotten to a certain point, but." They haven't gotten past that point. I think there's a reason they're called secondary pitches because they're not your first pitch.
Sure.
And for me, that's a kind of a silly thing to say that they want to that and that they think it's working.
Well, it's
that's
I mean
not the
you
reason,
know
that's not
everyone appreciates that you've got to establish a fastball.
Right, but that's not the reason they are where they are. They are where they are because they've had great talent, and they've coached that talent up. Some of those guys come in and aren't drafted. There are very few Brian Mattises or fourth-round picks unsigned who go to college. And they have Kyle Blair and some other guys like that. But they for all those guys, they had Anthony Slama.
Sure.
For all the, you know, they've done a great job developing people. It's about winning and developing. If all you do is win and
sure.
you don't develop, that recruiting pipeline will dry
Absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely.
And you know a great example of that is the University of Sliders and Curves. South Carolina has done a great job recruiting over the years. But they've done it in a way that I think has hurt some of their long-term recruiting, and they're having to reestablish that a little bit. And part of that is by a very negative attitude toward pro ball. I think South Carolina is getting away from that a little bit. And that's actually where Chad Holbrook, their new recruiting coordinator, has had a great relationship with scouts over the years when he was at North Carolina. And I think he's going to help change that reputation at South Carolina. But, you know, they had a great core assistant coaches group there for Ray Tanner when he had Jerry Myers and Jim Thoman there for a long time. But I think they alienated a lot of pro scouts, and that's where that nickname University of Sliders and Curves come from. And you can coach to win only so long. I think after a while that comes back to hurt you in recruiting, not help you, because players do – it's not all about winning for them to go to college.
Sure.
If they turn down pro money out of high school, they want to develop in college and go to Omaha. They want it all. You better try to give it to both of them. You better try to give both of them to the players, I mean.
I think you're absolutely right. My point is just that I think that there's an interesting debate out there.
Yeah.
And certainly I don't think it's mutually exclusive. You either win or you develop.
Right. I agree.
But I think that there's more than one way of looking at it.
When you're at USD though and you're facing, let's just throw out a weaker Portland club, Brian Mattis should throw a lot more fastballs than he probably did this year.
Yeah.
I don't mean to pick on USD, but Weinstein made a great point in his clinic, and I think someone else made this point too. There's some pretty weak 6, 7, 8, 9 hitters in college baseball, and if you can't attack those guys with a fastball with your top starting pitchers, you're just not thinking. You need to get some early count outs, And you can do that even with the metal bat. But Steve Smith, we had a great conversation with the Baylor coach, who obviously has a pitching background from his days as a Ron Polk assistant. You know, the metal bat changes things. And also, you know, you don't want as many balls in play in the college level as you do at the pro level because the defense is not as good.
That's why.
So metal bats make for balls that are dinks and other with a wood bat become hits with a metal bat. And the defense is not as good. So those are two pretty big factors for why you have to miss more bats.
And that's why I guess Eric's big point was, you know, hey, I wanna miss more bats. I don't pitch to contact. We pitch for the strikeout.
Right.
You know, we can't do like they do in pro ball, you know, just attack with a fastball over and over again. I mean, work up those high pitch counts because, again, you put balls in play, it's more likely something bad is going to happen at the college level.
Well, the interesting thing to me is that it's the West Coast teams that are generally pitching and defense teams that actually work more off the fastball. I never hear that complaint about Long Beach State. I never hear that complaint really about Cal State Fullerton.
You're right.
And those are and other pitching and defense clubs. And that's why I was surprised to hear that complaint about Oregon State last year from scouts, because that had been their identity for so many years. That's how they won back-to-back College World Series championships. And honestly, we saw it with Fresno last year. Even with a shortstop in Danny Muno, who made a lot of errors and was not an efficient defender, with Mendonca and Eric Wetzel at second base, that was a pretty darn good defensive infield. And those guys did pitch off the fastball in Omaha, and I think it was a big part of their success. But, of course, I look at everything through my fastball-obsessed prism. Even going to the extent of having dinner with a bunch of guys from Baseball Canada and Quebec Baseball. Met a scout who you talk to a lot,
Alex D'Agostino.
That's him. There you go. That's who I had dinner with Sunday night. So that was fun. He remembered your name. He pulled you out, and he's now working for the World Series champion Phillies. So Alex said hello.
Good.
He told his main man, Aaron Fitt, he said hello.
Well, Alex, if you're listening, right back at you.
Absolutely. So this is what happens at the College Baseball Podcast, what happens at the ABCA Convention. You get to talk about all these kind of great things. So it's a very useful convention, and Aaron wrapped it up by playing golf on Monday morning. How'd you shoot?
I'll tell you, I was okay, John. Not great.
What'd you shoot?
I don't want. That's not for public consumption.
All right. I was hoping to out you on but you had a beautiful day. Didn't you?
It was a gorgeous morning after a cold start.
It was. Well, I still think the highlight was talking with Roger Cador over dinner on Friday night. It was all downhill from there. but you can't. That is the high life. Eating barbecue at the Top Gun place, Kansas City Barbecue in San Diego, with Roger Cador.
And finding out later in the weekend, more Top Gun, Kevin Towers was on hand for the honors lunch
on
Sunday.
Awesome.
Apparently when Kevin Towers was in junior college.
When Kelly McGillis's breath was being taken away by Tom Cruise, to put it one way.
Kevin Towers stayed in the house, and I think it was in Oceanside or Carlsbad, somewhere like that.
Yeah, where they filmed it.
Where Kelly McGillis stayed in the Top Gun movie. So there you go.
That was his room, he said. So
That's right.
That was a little uncomfortable for all the old people at that at the honors luncheon. Don Preece, I think he blushed. But it was great to meet Don Preece. It was good to see Coach Polk, who will wear number 35 this year at Alabama Birmingham in honor of the NCAA. So.
Rob Fornasier, our assistant coach of the year this year, sat next to him for a while and had a really good conversation with him at that lunch. And he's a worthy recipient and a class act all the way.
He's good egg of the day, that's for sure. That was good to get to know him a little bit better. So this is the kind of thing you get to get all year at the Baseball America College Podcast. Only usually a little bit more focused, and we yell at each other a little bit more about what teams are good and which ones aren't. So much to look forward to on that front this year. And again, our top 25 rankings will come out in about 2 weeks at baseballamerica.com. For Aaron Fitt, I'm John Manuel. We'll be back next week with another Baseball America podcast. Until then, so long, everybody.